Our guest now has turned his lens on the athleticism and art involved in street dance. Luke Cornish spent years making his documentary Keep Stepping, which follows two young women on their journey to prepare for Destructive Steps, Australia's largest street dance competition. It's not just about the moves, which are impressive. It shows the role street dance has on competitors' lives and the empowerment they get from it. Keep Stepping is screening in New Zealand as part of the Dock Edge Festival. Luke started off working in children's television before moving to start his own company, Biscuit Tin Productions. The company's debut film, Alone Out Here, followed a gay farmer who sought to take on Australia's beef industry by breeding cattle that release lower levels of methane. Well, to discuss more about his work and what he discovered by immersing himself in the street dance subculture, Luke is with us now. Welcome. Good to talk to you. Can you hear me, Luke?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, there we are. We're connected. Yeah. Great to talk to
you.
Wonderful. It certainly is a passion, this. I think you filled just about every role in its filming, production, editing, marketing. Why was it a story that you really wanted to tell and, you know, dedicated 7 years to? Where did it begin for you?
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's very exciting. I started this journey actually when I was a tiny kid because I was just a huge, huge breakdance fan, or breaking as it's actually officially known, when I was tiny, and I wanted to be a breakdancer really badly. Grew up in London, became involved in the hip-hop scene there as a teenager and as a young adult, and then moved to Sydney when I was 29 and sort of looked for that scene over here. It took me a while to find it, but there was a practice spot in the heart of the CBD here in Sydney, and I saw these breakers there every single night, come rain, shine, like any condition, they were there practicing. And one night I was walking back from the cinema and I just walked up to them and told them I was a filmmaker, told them I was really interested in exploring their story. And that's kind of how I got involved with it. Funnily enough, the first boy I spoke to literally said, I should get you to speak to our leader. And I was introduced to Joe Wan, who's actually the founder of Destructive Steps, which is the biggest street dance competition in Australia and is what the film is kind of centered around in terms of a sort of a mission for the two female protagonists.
It's so fascinating. You mentioned breaking, or what we call break dancing. I don't know whether you were a child of the 80s, but, you know, that,
yes.
that was where music videos would certainly introduce many of us to this. If you're living in a city like London that has a scene, you're seeing it right in front of your eyes. But this is one of the interesting things about this. There's not just one style of dance. There are different categories. There are different subcultures. There's debate even over what qualifies as street dance. Can you take us on a tour?
Yeah, I mean, there really is. There's kind of their own version of politics, although I will say that it is an extremely open and welcoming community. And the way they just bring me in as someone who really had no connection, I was literally a stranger walking up to them, is what they've done for everybody, particularly people who are coming from overseas. Like, as I was like spending more and more time with the particular crew that I started with, people would arrive into Sydney with almost no English, turn up there, they would have heard or read about this particular breakdance spot, turn up and be welcomed. And I noticed that regardless of language barriers, people were communicating in a different way and like finding some roots in a community that would show them around Sydney, would take them to places beyond maybe where you'd be you'd have access to if you were just arriving here without knowing anybody. So that's one thing I noticed. And then I noticed the absolute and utter shift when it came to the battle scene, where people who were incredibly welcoming and incredibly friendly just turn on each other. And I don't mean that, like, it wasn't not in a violent way,
yeah,
but in a, I am going to destroy you,
yeah,
in this art form that we kind of are so into. But, you know, it's a really interesting mix. So you get people who are incredibly humble and incredibly quiet, and some of them are the meekest, loveliest, politest people you'll ever meet, and they do a 180 degree personality transformation when the music starts. And I love that so much.
It's like the pre-boxing match, kind of eyeball to eyeball. Look, obviously the culture, the universality of the culture, the language, as you say, that is not a spoken language, it is a dance language, is a big part of the theme. But just technically, some of us are familiar with, I think my nieces taught me to crump briefly, badly, this breaking, this locking, this popping. Some of the dance styles were technically born in clubs. You think of the likes of house, for example, and voguing. So that's often a, you know, some won't consider them street dances. But are all of these dance forms, do people specialise in one? Do they specialise in several? How does it work as a, I guess, an overall art form or form of culture?
Well, I mean, yes, people do specialize, absolutely, and the film follows a female breaker who specialized in that form, but she started off popping, which is a completely different style of dance. Has less sort of like power moves, if you like, and is more of like a standing style, full of like very intricate, isolated movement. Whereas the other subject, Gabby, who's actually in New Zealand for the screening, she does popping, and doesn't do the sort of the windmills and the head spins and all that style. But both hold a lot of weight. Like not one style is considered better than the other, just incredibly different. But the other thing that's kind of amazing about this culture is not only do people switch styles, but because it's freestyle, it doesn't have the same type of regulation, if you like, the other more traditional styles of dance have. Like I've just spent the last year and a half within a performing arts academy who do, you know, ballet, contemporary, jazz, like all the traditional styles, and they're, you know, very strict about what happens there. There's form and there's a history that's gone before it, whereas freestyle is so, it encourages something new and it encourages you to be organic, and it's about a storytelling and a sort of more of an emotive experience that comes from the heart that just it really captivated me because it really doesn't, it doesn't, you don't have to just even do one style in that battle. People do, they mix it up and they get so much love for it if they can execute it well.
So this is the thing. This is expressive. This is, as we said, a dance language. It's not about perfecting a style from 200 years ago and you know, possibly adapting that. There are obviously moves that are familiar to a certain style, but this is about your expression and your communication. Before we meet Patrick's and Gabby, the two dancers that you followed through, tell us a little bit more about Joe One. And the destructive steps event itself, was he instrumental in its becoming what it's become?
Oh, absolutely. Jojo Wan is the leader, who he actually hates me saying that, but that is literally what I was told. And that's how he is considered by the community. You know, he's incredibly like he's an incredibly strong person who literally started Destructive Steps, his competition, you know, independently. You know, he had some help from the community, but he started it with his Centrelink money. You know, he has grown it into such a huge thing that people are coming from all over the world to compete in. He's getting government grants now. Like I like to think that the film has helped progress that status because it took me so long to put together, and I was just so acutely aware of like how much the community were giving me. You know, I was making promotional videos for them in my spare time and trying to get, you know, local councils to see what they were doing. So he's really like he's such a tenacious, organized, and like he's just someone who can make stuff happen. And that was interesting to me and very different from everybody else. And Joe's actually Korean, and we were flown to Korea to like the biggest film festival in that country. And it was so interesting to hear why they picked the film and some of the themes that you've touched on. Actually, what they talked to me about bringing you know, different cultures together, and they saw something. I didn't intend to do it, but it was a surprise to hear government officials and people who have fundamentally, you know, have dealt with the civil war in their country look at this film. It was played in the DMZ, the demilitarized zone there, and they were talking about the impact they felt it would have on the people, people who are living together but have completely different ideologies, who are able to battle but are able to actually come together afterwards. And that was sort of mind-blowing for me, to see how a film can start, you know, literally on a rainy night in the streets of Sydney and end up going to huge kind of to have huge impact on people in different countries and on histories that are so much bigger than, you know, any of us who are actually kind of involved in the film.
He's interesting because a lot of this we're talking, Australia is one of the great, you know, diaspora migrant countries. I mean, it's, you know, extraordinary, the range of cultures that you will find living there, including from quite recent migration since the 50s. And in his instance, he talks in the film about being moved to an area of Sydney that would help him to learn to speak English better. This is Joe Wan, and he was one of five Asian kids in a 1,000-strong school. So where he finds hip-hop culture in his case, he begins to find what? Again, this breaking down of barriers from the strictures of who you are, what you look like, what your English is like, what school you go to. There's a different language, a universal language, yeah?
Mm. It's a cliche, but it really is like it's a chosen family for the people that I met. You know, it really is. And for people who, I mean, ultimately, there's, you know, so many people from so many backgrounds, and a lot of them are like, you know, just incredible people. And it was a way in which they found they could express themselves, and a way in which, you know, like, I mean, I'm sure Joe won't mind me saying this because it's talked about in the film, but, you know, he did not have an easy time with his dad growing up. And when I look at him, he's literally a father figure to the scene. It's so, I feel like he didn't even realize that. And I certainly didn't. And we explored that together through one of the interviews, and I was asking him, like, do you realize these people actually tell me that you're their father figure? They have said those words to me. And I watched someone so stoic just have a little crack in front of me. And you know, I just asked him, you know, do you think you did a better job than, you know, your dad has done with you? And he just said, you know, I really hope so. And to me, it was such a touching moment of genuine discovery that we went through together. Obviously it's more profound for Joe, but just amazing for me to witness. And that's kind of a joy of this process. Like, you actually don't know what's going to happen. I didn't have that written on my questions when I went to interview him. You know, it was through spending time with him and learning about these characters through other people as well, who would reveal so much to me about the things they had done for each other, because people don't like to talk about themselves often like that.
Let's talk about your two main subjects, Patricia and Gabby. And Gabby, I've just got the film playing in the background now just to get back in the vibe, and I'm watching some wonderful Pacific Island moves, hip moves that that will never match. Yeah. And this is the thing, people can bring their own cultural dance influences into their performances. She's someone else who's open again about not fitting in, right, or feeling like she fits in. Tell us about her. Tell us about Patricia, their backstories and why they came to this, you know, world.
Well, I mean, I'll start with Gabby, just since she mentioned her dance style, and it connects so well to the points we were talking about before. It's like Gabby, she's a popper, right, which is a particular style. She integrated, as she learned more about her traditional dance called Jasiva, she was able to or had the idea of incorporating that into her battles. So she would start off a style body popping and then bring in these traditional moves into it. And I saw it first when we were actually in Singapore at an international battle there. I knew, like, she was so frightened before she did it, because it hadn't been done before. And she wore half traditional clothing. And it's what the scene celebrates. I mean, she had to execute it perfectly, which she did. But you can literally come into a battle doing one thing and transform it into another. And she brought the house down. Like, I've got goosebumps even remembering what happened, because we didn't, to witness it, you don't actually know what's taking place because it looks so different to anything else. And Gabby is somebody who like personifies that space of like freestyle and originality. And, you know, my job was to witness things like that, be given that incredible gift of like, you know, just being able to turn the camera on and something amazing happen. And then I would investigate, like, where's that come from? How has that happened? You know, what has influenced and motivated Gabby to bring those things together? And so we learned more about her family and her experience as, you know, a human being. And she's mixed race, and she talked a lot about that. She's a Samoan and Chilean background, and you know, those influences really had a big impact on her, you know, because she was, I mean, what she said to me, and again, I don't want to speak for her, but she does say this in the film, you know, that being a mix, she never felt entirely connected or 100% one thing. And so I just don't think it's a coincidence that she integrated different styles and felt that that was a more of an expression of her than doing one thing, which I just thought was amazing. And like, so did the whole scene, because she was bringing people to tears in the room or getting people on their feet. Like, it was genuine. It's like the stuff that she has done are genuine moments in battle culture history. You know, she's got tons of views on YouTube. Like, you can see what she's capable of doing, you know?
Yeah. Patricia, or Patria, I think is the pronunciation, and she performs as Patrix. She talks about it being a heavily male-dominated scene, and I'm interested in your observations of that, and was that a factor in you deciding to follow the progress of two women, or did they just present for other reasons as being, you know, the most kind of rounded representations of, you know, what were your observations of the subculture of the subculture, if you like?
It's so well put. It is a subculture and a subculture. I mean, particularly with breaking, it's so male dominated. You know, women haven't felt, I guess, like, I don't know if it is welcome or wanted, or I don't know what the right words are to use around it. I don't know what motivated those people, but that certainly is like, for every 9 boys, there's 1 girl. And I might be exaggerating. It might be less than that. You know, I think when Patrix first came into the scene in Australia, she said she was the only breaking girl there. But Patricia is both. So I followed both these people partly for like bigger reasons, like you're talking about, that you know, are more political and, you know, investigatory, and partly because it's no coincidence that people who are in this scene, women who are in this scene, who are doing it against so many odds, are more like, they have a particularly interesting story. So that's what also drew me to them. I mean, originally Joe was, it's actually quite a big reason why we did redirect to women at one stage, because we were, you know, exploring many characters and Joe was helping me. And it was actually the Me Too movement when it first hit. Joe and I were talking a lot, because hip hop is not a straightforward thing to enjoy always. And, you know, I'm gay. There's a lot of homophobic language in hip hop that I've had to reconcile with. Joe was talking to me about the way in which some hip hop talks about women, and that we were trying to reconcile with this love and this passion for this culture that also has, there's some things that we don't agree with, if you can put it like that. And he was talking to me about following some women, and I'd already met Patricia. In fact, Patricia met me. I did not meet Patricia. I have the footage of me filming a random freestyle battle, and you can see through the camera get bumped. I get pushed out of the way, And then the cap that I was wearing on my head whilst filming appears on Patricia's head and flies through the front of the lens. And she's stolen my cap, bumped me out of the way, and then presented herself to freestyle in front of me, because Patricia is a born performer and she will not let a camera go past her without making sure she's going to take advantage of that moment. And that is 100% who she is. And I'm like, how could you not follow that as a documentary subject?
I get it. The battles, just on a technical note, how are they scored?
They're actually down to it's changing and evolving, particularly as breaking comes into the Olympics, and there's a lot of debate around this. But at the moment, the battles that I show in the film, and you know, this is how they're most commonly judged by a panel. It's often three people, but it could be more or less. And it's their subjective opinion of what is best. Of course, they're basing it on many things and what is kind of acceptable and understood. But they have their own criteria, but it's not questioned. It's like, it's their opinion fundamentally of what is the best.
Wow. The Olympic move, that's interesting. There's a Kiwi connection here. Holly Thorpe, who's an academic at Waikato University, advised the International Olympic Committee on some of these new sports, things like parkouring, rock climbing, skateboarding, and I don't know if breaking was in there. Basically saying, if you're going to stick with sort of Greco-Roman wrestling and, you know, forever, although it's lasted a while, you know, you're not going to capture a new generation. But I'm interested if that's controversial. Again, can you be a subculture and be in the Olympics? And, you know, what does it do to the heart and soul and essence of what your movement's about? And is that being discussed? Or
it's definitely being discussed. It's being discussed in, you know, it's difficult, I think, for the scene to get their head around. I'm certainly not one that can speak at any great authority on the subject, only what I've witnessed and what I kind of understand. I think, of course, you can be a subculture and be in the Olympics. I don't see as that being a threat to it in any way. The only thing that I look at is when you put a scoring system in place, what happens to the artistry, and can that still be front and center, you know? And or do you move into the space where you look at gymnastics, for example, and to the layman's eye, it's very hard to tell what is a 9.5 and what is a 9.9. We're talking about intricacies that are so fine because everyone's perfecting, you know, a range of movement, whereas you might not have to have the cleanest line, for example, in breaking, but you might have captured the audience's imagination in that moment. And that will trump how clean your footwork is. And I mean, that's just from a fan perspective. I know what I love, but I just want the most and the best for the scene. You know, I want that for this film. I want that for the subjects. I witness them put so much love, effort, their whole lives are dedicated to this, and I seriously mean that. And you know, there's not a lot of compensation, there's not a lot of money, there's not a lot of regular work, and these are artists, they're craftspeople, they're professionals, and no one expects to pay them. And I, even if it's a tiny bit, like, I want the people within this scene that I have connected with and have given me their time, I want them to get work, and I want the scene to be bigger for them for that reason. And I'm hoping that the more publicity through the Olympics and through documentaries like this, that will actually happen.
It's really interesting though, isn't it? Because that's the point of the street in some ways. Come here, don't care who you are, don't care whether you speak English, don't even care if you know how to do this yet, just come. And when you start professionalising something, you know, but to your point, someone says it's a 40-hour-a-week training schedule. It's a great opening to the film, which shows someone just trying to begin doing a head spin, just get up and do it. And, you know, 40 hours a week, I think someone was saying they were training. Someone else says he's got five jobs and struggling to find
on top of that
to train. So, again, it's what do you do that doesn't lose the essence, but to your point, just gives this the recognition that it needs, or the it's there. Anyway, fascinating storytelling, and thanks very much for sharing it. That is Luke Cornish's latest film, is Keep Stepping. It's screening as part of the Dock Edge Festival. You can find more detail on our webpage, rnz.co.nz/9 to noon.